This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In 1912, Virginia Christian became the only black juvenile woman executed in the state of Virginia. She was sent to the electric chair the day after her 17th birthday for murdering her white employer. Virginia's story is the backdrop for a new novel, Forsaken. The book blends fact and fiction and shows how Jim Crow laws affected the teenager's trial. It also features a young, idealistic white journalist who covers Virginia's case, and he tries to help her avoid the chair. Ross Howell, Jr. is the author of Forsaken. He'll be at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro tonight at 7 o'clock, but first joins me in the studio. Welcome, Ross. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Tell us more about the real life of Virginia Christian and the case.
Well, not a great deal is known about the girl herself. She lived in poverty. She was in a large family. Like many of the black African-Americans who lived in Hampton, Virginia at the time, they'd actually found their freedom coming to Fort Monroe during the American Civil War. She lived in close proximity to not only black families, but lived close by the white family where this murder occurred.
And she was working for that white family?
Yes, she washed clothes. She'd been washing clothes for the family from the time that she was 13 years old. She had been in school really only, the only record we could find that she had been in school was from age 10 to age 13. And for some reason, a reason I could never discover, her mother somehow became paralyzed. And so they had to pull her out of school so that she could work and contribute to the family income.
And how much do we know about the murder itself?
Well,
the killing?
Well, quite a bit. Actually, the coroner's report that appears in the book is taken verbatim from the actual coroner's inquest. And it shows that it was a pretty violent crime scene. The woman was 51 years old. Her health was not good. She was tiny. She was only 5 feet tall and by some reports weighed less than 100 pounds. And she was had been struck, so there was a lot of blood on the scene, and then also she had been pretty brutally strangled, and that's how she suffocated and lost her life.
How did you find this story in the first place?
I came to this story in kind of an unusual way. I grew up in the mountains of Virginia, and in my part of Virginia, there was a legendary story about a shootout in the Hillsville courthouse, which occurred the same year. It occurred just about a week before this murder. And I was doing some research on that. I thought I might, the centennial of that event was coming up. I thought I might write an article about it. And I came across this letter that had been sent by an attorney to the governor of Virginia saying that he had not allowed his client to testify in court because of what had happened. He was afraid there would be an outbreak of violence in that courtroom as it happened in Hillsville. So I was curious about that. I thought, well, you know, maybe this is a way we could say this is another casualty of that shootout. And that was the first time his client was Virginia Christian. That was the first time that I'd ever found her name. And so I started doing the research. And the more I learned about the story, the more I just found myself unable to turn away.
Of course, one of the most significant factors is she really shouldn't have been brought to trial as an adult in the first place, right?
That's absolutely correct. In the Virginia Constitution in 1902, no juvenile was even to be incarcerated, much less to face the death penalty. But the stipulation was that such a youth would be put in a juvenile home, not unlike today. And then at some point later, once they had learned a trade, a determination would be made about what would happen next. The problem in Virginia was that unfortunately for black people, for black girls, there was no such institution. And unavoidable fact was she was a black person who had taken the life of a white person. And that was sort of the ultimate Jim Crow crime.
Right. And you also make references to the lingering fears that go back nearly a century to remember, this is 1912, the Nat Turner Rebellion.
Yes. The narrator, Charlie Mears, actually grew up in Southampton County, which is where the Nat Turner insurrection took place. And in the South, it was always a problem of numbers. Black people outnumbered white people. And the insurrection was pretty horrific. More than 50 people, men, women, and children, were killed. It was done brutally. It was done with knives and farm implements because they didn't want to. The insurrectionists did not want to use guns because the reports would warn other plantations of what was happening.
So, tell us more about Charlie Mears, who is one of the main characters in this book.
Charlie really became a favorite of mine. What happened was I had started the novel and written a big portion of it, and I went back and took a day and reviewed it, and it really just wasn't working. I think I had so much information. I was trying so hard to get everything in there to try to make this authentic, and it was awful. And so I thought, well, I need someone who can – if I had a witness, then that would make it more appealing. That would make it more real. And so I realized in my research that I had found just the right person, because I needed someone who not only had access to the black girl, but who also would have access to the halls of power, even to the governor's mansion. And I had found that person in the newspaper man, Charles Mears. He was one of two reporters who had actually interviewed the girl after she was found guilty and convicted and sentenced to death. And she wanted to talk to reporters because she wanted to tell her story. She always believed if she could just tell what happened, that she would be spared. And so Charles himself was unique in that he is the only journalist who actually tried historically to save this girl's life. He intervened with the governor twice, trying to get him to grant clemency, arguing that his interview with her showed that there was no premeditation in the crime, but his appeal fell on deaf ears.
Can I get you to read for us from the beginning of the book and give us another sense of Charles Mears?
Yes, background. This is where he's giving a little bit of his background about his youth, and he often visited this hermit who lived near his home, and the hermit was an old man who claimed that he had actually witnessed the Nat Turner insurrection. The walk home after one of my visits was a torture of shadows and crickets and rustling marsh grass. Sometimes the old man would show me an artifact he kept wrapped with canvas and twine in his wood box. He said it was the leg bone from Nat Turner's skeleton, given him by a doctor said to have assembled it after the slave was mutilated. The old man let me touch it with my fingertips, gazing wide-eyed on him himself as if he held a relic from the Holy Land. The bone might simply have been carried in by one of the old man's hounds. The story of it could have been imagined from beginning to end. But as he spun his tail, sitting on his haunches like a wild creature, his eyes gleaming, his unkempt beard flecked with spit, terror sprang up in the Southampton fields beyond his cabin walls. Rainwater in puddles after a storm was thick with blood. Birdsong echoed with the screams of dying women and children. Sighs and axe blades glinted in moonlit pastures, or so it seemed to me as a boy.
Ross Howell Jr. reading from his novel Forsaken. You chose to make this. I mean, the story is compelling, and there are these real-life characters, an actual white journalist who intervenes and gives some voice to the victim in this, one of the two victims. There was a murder victim and, of course, the woman who's put to death at the age of 17. Give her a voice. Why did you choose to make this a novel?
I was surprised at the amount of actual historical material that I was able to find. I found a number of photographs that I thought I wouldn't be able to locate. But I have to say, I felt all along that I wanted to be able to bring this girl to life. You know, it's one thing to say that, well, there's a 16-year-old girl sitting in the Richmond Penitentiary, isolated. But her cell was actually in view of the death chamber where she would die. So I have a scene in the book where Charlie comes to try to comfort her. He brings her a little cake that his maid has prepared, and they have a birthday celebration. And so here, if you have this living child, she was a child after all, celebrating her 17th birthday, looking out at the place where she knew she would die the next morning, I felt if I could bring that to life, that somehow that would create an empathy in the reader than if I just did a history where it said, Well, this unfortunate child was executed, and that was the end of her life.
Right, and of course, for capital murder, you need premeditation, and her argument in this case, I don't think there was an argument or dispute over whether she actually did the killing, was responsible for it, but whether it was premeditated or a form of perhaps self-defense or response to something else that happened.
Yes, she was. The crime scene showed that something had there was this shattered crockery. She said that the widow had thrown the crockery at her and it had broken on her, and it made her angry. And their argument continued from there. There wasn't a question of her action, but yeah, the matter of premeditation was also big. The other big factor is that her age was very important as to whether or not she was a juvenile. And her defense attorneys did a good job of showing. They found her actual school records, which showed that she had been born in 1895, and these records were created four years before the crime, so there was no reason to try to fabricate this. Right. But still, again, I think the fist of Jim Crow just crushed any hope she had.
And that's certainly where the injustice is evident, both in her age and the fact that this was not a capital crime, or pretty good evidence that it wasn't a capital crime. Mm-hmm. But so, and tell us more about the defense attorney also, I think, plays an important role in this story and, again, illuminates some of the complexities of this period.
It was really, I had done a lot of research, and it was really when I came across the historical character, George Washington Fields, that I knew I had to tell his story. He escaped. He was a slave in Hanover County, Virginia. He escaped with his family. He was about 8 years old at that time. He escaped with his family on a skirmish along the lines, got behind federal lines, and like many of African Americans of the time, made his way to Fort Monroe. He would go on to, and at that time, slaves, by law in Virginia, were forbidden to be taught to read or even to have a book. So it was really probably not until he had got to Hampton that he even began to learn to read. He would go on to become the very first African American to graduate from Cornell Law School. He went back to Hampton and started a very successful practice. And then here's where a mystery emerged. In some of the newspaper accounts of the murder and his defense, some of the writers would refer to him as the blind George Washington Fields. And I thought, well, could this be? Well, sure enough, another fascinating thing that happened is I came across an actual relative of his. Her name is Ahena Carson Rogers. She is the senior park ranger at the Maggie L. Walker Historic Site in Richmond, Virginia. And she, of course, does historical reenactments. So I got in touch with her, found out that she had an unpublished autobiography that Fields had written late in his life. And I thought, I'm going to be able to solve this mystery of how he lost his sight. And all that he wrote was, in 1896, I had the great misfortune to lose my eyesight, period. That's all that he said.
So, but he became an attorney and the first graduate, as you say, from that was 1896. He's now a lawyer in 1912. He went to law school without his sight.
Well, this happened after.
After law school.
It was after law school, and he had just gotten married.
I see.
His practice was going along great. And then this happened.
But he continued to practice law.
Yeah.
And you also indicate in this that he has some questions. He is also living under the shadow of Jim Crow. He wants to see justice done, but he has to move cautiously and thoughtfully through this trial.
Here was his dilemma. He had a daughter, Inez, who was about the same age as Virginia Christian. She was a year older, and she was attending Hampton Institute at the time. She was everything that Virginia Christian was not. Virginia Christian was 5 feet tall, stocky. Her 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 skin dark as chocolate. Inez was tall, beautiful, intelligent, and she would go on to law school in at the University of Massachusetts and come back and practice as an attorney with her father. The great danger for black people in George Field's position is that here's a professional man. Basically, his goal in life is to remain invisible. In other words, as long as he is active in the black community, as long as nothing happens untoward outside into the white community, his life can be secure, his family can be secure. And so I have it in the novel that because my narrator, Charlie Mears, asked him a question about something that happened in the courtroom, and he said, his response, again, it's a fictional response, picture this, Charlie, picture that I had two young black girls, both of them counting on me for their lives. And that was George Field's dilemma in my mind.
The book, I'm talking today to author Ross Howell Jr. on the state of things, talking about his novel Forsaken. I think you illustrate the complexities of all this beautifully. And using fiction is probably, you know, a great way to go because, again, you're able to sort of flesh out some of these lives. In the book, Charles Mears speaks out against Jim Crow. And eventually that brings him to the attention of the white supremacist group that actually existed. Tell us about the Anglo-Saxon clubs of America.
The Anglo-Saxon clubs were nascent at the time of the trial. One of the founders is an absolutely brilliant man, a man named John Powell from Richmond, Virginia. He was an internationally recognized prodigy as a concert pianist and as a composer. But he was a virulent racist. And he was one of the founding fathers of what was the Anglo-Saxon clubs of America. It was basically the way I describe it is it was a KKK for rich white people. The Anglo-Saxon clubs actually looked down on the violence of the Klan, what they saw as the secret to what they called themselves the final solution for the Negro problem was through the science of genetics and eugenics and the law. And so, unfortunately for Charlie, he gets on the radar of these guys, again, these very powerful, moneyed people, and he pays a dear price for it.
Now, what you had, and I don't have too much time left, but you have the option, of course, when you write a novel, of giving everything a happy ending. This ends up, this is a very dark subject matter. It's sad and gloomy in many, many ways for us to think about our history this way and how much it plays a part in today's life. And for Charles Mears, it doesn't end happily either in some ways.
It does not. At least, I don't want to give too much away, but I did want to end the novel on a hopeful note. I do feel that it does end that way. I think hope is something we all need because I've had people comment on how a lot of the issues that occurred a century ago are so current in our society now. And I think if anybody could take something away from the book, I hope it would be empathy and also resolve to honor human dignity.
And to keep the fight going, my guest, author Ross Howell Jr., his new novel, Forsaken, looks at the real-life case of Virginia Christian, a black juvenile executed in 1912. Ross is going to read tonight at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro at 7 o'clock. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Just ahead, members of the Mallarmé Chamber Players give a preview of music by composer Carl Heinrich Bieber. Stay tuned.